Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Sergio Navarreta, a filmmaker whose features include Looking for Angelina and The Colossal Failure of the Modern Relationship, starring friend of the show Enrico Colantoni. His newest film, The Cuban, stars Louis Gossett Jr. as an elderly musician who has a profound impact on the life of his new personal support worker, played by Ana Goya. After premiering last month at the Lovazza Drive-In Film Festival, The Cuban is now playing in theaters across the U.S. and drive-ins around Canada. Tonight, Tuesday, August 11th, it's screening at the Sunset Drive-In in Barrie, Ontario. Maybe check it out. Sergio picked La Dolce Vita, Federico Fellini's 1960 smash about a disaffected writer named Marcello, played by Marcello Mastroianni, who spends a week palling around with Rome's most talented and beautiful artists, only to find that all the glamour in Europe can't give substance to a shallow, empty celebrity culture. And while the film was intended as a critique of post-war European decadence, audiences embraced that decadence, turning La Dolce Vita into an international sensation and sparking a new obsession with all things Italian. Which sort of proves Fellini's point, I think. This is someone else's movie.
Being of Italian heritage, I like to go for the high drama, and you know, I was mortified after I had suggested it. I said, I'm going to be with Norm Wilner talking about La Dolce Vita, which university courses have been based on. It's like one of the most complex, iconic films of all time. It's like I was kicking myself saying, damn it, why didn't I choose Rocky or Reservoir Dogs or Serpico? And I just realized that, you know, it's my same approach to making movies. I really like challenging myself and digging deep into why I do things or why I'm attracted to certain things. And that film for me changed my life. I had like a spiritual experience watching it. It sort of encompasses everything that I am and who I am today because of the way that I was brought up. So my parents dragged me to all these schlocky Italian films when I was a kid, and Italian was my first language. And anytime we would watch a Hollywood movie by accident or even on purpose, my parents would roll their eyes and say, ah, of course it has a happy ending. You know, that's Hollywood. That's not real life. So that shaped my worldview. And so, you know, obviously I grew up watching, you know, a lot of neorealistic films, and La Dolce Vita was sort of at the tail end of that whole, you know, what the war did to Italy was obviously devastating and just plummeted the country and just caused, I mean, not just Italy, but like the whole world, but most, you know, I can only speak to personal experiences and stories that I heard through relatives. And I think neorealism really was a direct reflection. It was a social commentary on what was happening. And it was, you know, kind of how artists expressed themselves and kind of took aim at the social political systems and even religion, you know. And then leading to 1960, I think Fellini was sort of maybe tired of neorealism. It's sort of like he reinvented it with that movie. He made it more fantastical, more glamorous. But I think, you know, for a fact, I mean, I think he was pointing to some very important themes that are relevant today. Yeah,
I think having just done Knights of Cabiria like 3 weeks ago with Peter Sarsgaard, and I hadn't seen the film in, I'm going to say 20 years, probably. And to revisit it and realize that it is, like, it's the tipping point for what he'll do in La Dolce Vita, because it's aware of celebrity and it's got all the elements that that this film is about, but it is so narrowly focused on someone who is excluded from all of it. She's an outsider wherever she goes. And that comes into conversation with the sad clown iconography of it, and how Giulietta Messina is just, you know, like so beautifully upbeat and optimistic as this world gets uglier and uglier around her. And then La Dolce Vita flips that, right? Because it's somebody who can't experience the pleasures that are on offer all the time in this gigantic world that welcomes him, that wants him to be part of it all the time. And that's a really, like, that's a conversation Fellini's clearly having in his head for the 3 years between the two movies.
100%.
And then he chooses to do it in a fantastical way, because that's in itself, that's the precursor to 8.5, right? Like, this is such an important film in his artistic evolution. I think maybe it's the pinnacle. I think it's the one where he doesn't fully understand the alchemy that's happening, and so he just goes with it. 8.5 is much more composed and more, you know, the barriers between fantasy and reality are much more solid. But this is that liminal experience of just being with Mastroianni as he sort of plays tour guide to Fellini's own psychology, right? I don't know any other way to explain it, but it's such a fascinating, defining film. I've been trying to think of another director who came up with that sort of identifiable spot on his evolutionary path, where you can find, you can point to this movie and say, no, it was right here. It was making this movie, where you can see everything he was and everything he's going to be, all in one epic moment.
Would you say that Eyes Wide Shut was that for Kubrick?
Well, that's more like a culmination, right? Because it's his final film. We can't know where he would have gone. But I see what you mean.
But thematically, it's similar.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's also his last film, so we can't know where he would have gone afterwards. And maybe he wasn't planning to make another movie. This does feel like after 20 years, he had one statement left to make. But, not 20 years, sorry. 11? Full Metal Jacket was 87?
Yeah.
12. Yeah. But with Fellini, he's got 25 years of work ahead of him. He's got all the fantastical stuff that he hints at here, but isn't fully willing to explore because he's still grounded in his way. It's it's a movie that I watch it and I see him wanting to go in those directions. It's wanting to grab the camera and be pulled up the way it happens in 8.5, but he's not there yet. He's still trying to figure out what it means. And that mirrors the storyline too, which is someone trying to figure out where they are, who they are, what they want to do with their lives. It's just that it's a cauldron of all of the ideas and all of the thoughts all at once. And it is so beautifully willing to be overwhelmed, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
It's so impactful too. It's one of those movies you watch and it somehow digs into your subconscious and stays there. Yeah. And even though I didn't realize it, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do is super influenced by Fellini and especially this movie. Some of the themes that I obsess about in my own life, you know, in this business, at least I've had the privilege of going to places like Monaco or Cannes and being around like just extreme excess, like to the point of where, you know, I'm looking at these people going, they have it all. It must be the answer. So it's like this, it's really, I think the movie takes a critical look at the chasing and pursuit of false gods. You know, the opening image is a gold Jesus being flown with a helicopter over Rome, which is a direct attack, I guess, at the church, at everything that is Italian. And in a lot of ways, being Italian, we're indoctrinated into this way of thinking where we're religious and on some level, even if we're critical, it's there. We're superstitious because of all the pagan, influences that have seeped their way into our culture.
Sure, yeah.
And then there's that whole intellectual part, that academic part that says this is all nonsense. So I think Fellini, that's what it felt for me. It was sometimes it's like torment. It's like tormenting to watch La Dolce Vita. It's so, it's a tour de force. And I don't know how it affected you, but it really weighs on me and really forces me to look at my own life. And when a film can do that, that's like, it's done its job, you know, and this idea of, what are we really chasing? Like the American dream is all about that, is really,
sure,
you know, the pursuit of wealth. And then once you have it all, then what? And that's the question, you know. I was fortunate in my life where I met people that had, you know, tons of wealth and they weren't happy. They were miserable. So that's when in my 20s, my wheels started turning. It's like, so I've been to parties like that with, you know, where Marcello was kind of like in a place where he should be elated and totally present in the moment and enjoying himself, but he's not. He's miserable. He's isolated and he feels lonely. And I think, you know, that scene is so poignant when he's with his father, because for a moment you see that the humanity in him, and even that's fleeting because his father disappears. And the other thing that struck me watching it again was the moment where he's at his typewriter writing his novel and he sees the young girl from Umbria or whatever, the young waitress, and you see that twinkle in his eye. It's like that little sliver of hope, you know, and then that's fleeting. And then he goes back to his kind of, you know, I guess, restless life. And it's funny how she comes back right at the end to offer him, you know, it leaves it open. It's ambiguous. It's, you know, he said, I think she represents that purity and hope that he once had, but he just looks at her in waves and turns around and walks away. It's like, he's kind of like helpless. And in American cinema standards, that would be a fail. It's like the arc isn't big enough. He doesn't walk off into the sunset. It's like, you know, it's horrible. And it leaves you thinking and wondering, but that's the brilliance of a great master, I think.
I'm trying to think of how many movies Fellini has made that just end on that note of the, well, we'll get there. Like, they hoping as a society that everybody, like, Cabiria gets it. Cabiria gets her moment where she can just leave everything behind and walk off into the future unprepared, because she's finally got to the point where she can sacrifice the idea of sacrifice, that all the things that were important to her before, they're gone. Why worry about them? Why carry that burden? Just join the parade and walk on and see what happens. Marcello feels to me like his responsibility, he thinks his responsibility is to cover the parade so he can never join it. He can never fully embrace it. And so much of that mirrors Fellini as a filmmaker, as a spectator, even in things like Amarcord or not so much Roman Satyricon, because those are just much more outre visions anyway. But so many of Fellini's films end with him watching someone watch something. Like, just this further removing the audience as the world goes on forward and we're left there, and the camera is left there, so are we. And it's this fascinating... I was going to say, the first time I saw the movie was in film school in New York in year one, and I was not ready for it. I would have been 18. My entire experience of Fellini was probably like an SCTV parody here or there. I'd never seen any of his films. And, you know, we're going to watch this, and it's 3 hours long, and everything about it seemed to be positioning me for, this is going to be the stereotypical Fellini experience, that you're just going to be overwhelmed forever and it won't end. Yeah. And I liked it a lot, but I didn't love it until I saw it again. Maybe I saw it at the Bloor when I saw it properly theatrically, but we saw movies at York in a tiny little theater, and it was on 35 and it looked nice, but it was an old print and a lot of restless 18-year-olds, so it didn't really play. And then I saw it at the Bloor maybe 5 or 6 years later. It was the mid-90s.
What is it, a retrospective maybe? They used to do retrospectives at the Bloor.
Maybe, yeah. Now I'm even wondering if I'm misremembering it and I saw it at Cinema. No, I didn't. I saw it at Cinematheque the third time I saw it. But every time I watch it, I'm more open to it. I find myself more willing to surrender, more willing to abandon myself to what it wants to do. Because and you know, the more you get to know a movie, the easier it is to take it the second time, even if it's a film you don't necessarily like very much, because your brain knows where the map is and you can respond to different things. And I find the hollowness of the world that he's showing us gets more interesting. Like the mm-hmm. vacuum is the thing that fascinates me now.
Yeah.
Just watching people painted up, suited up, dolled up, whatever you want to call it, this garish idea of what celebrity is. And this is from a director who's already been to Cannes a number of times. He's won prizes. He's already as feted as anybody's going to be for doing the thing they do. And his take is just, oh God, I don't like any of this. I want to be away from it. I want to be sitting at a table somewhere and not having to perform a version of myself. And this, like this last viewing, just it felt shattering. And I just don't know what changed about me in the, I'm going to guess 10 years since I last watched it, maybe 12 or 13 even. I don't know why maybe this is telling me I need to do something else with my
life. More cynical?
Oh, I'm definitely more cynical. But the movie has always been that cynical. Like, that's what I mean. It took me this long to catch up to that. I'm cynical anyway. Jeez.
I think what's most depressing about it is really how, you know, during a conversation once, we were sort of joking around and playing with this idea of what if we, you know, remade La Dolce Vita today, would it work? And that's the terrifying part, is that whether you're talking about the paparazzi, the media, that, you know, like at his lowest point, when he, you know, he gets punched out in front of the hotel, his own friends are there trying to get the shot.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like society hasn't changed. Like, I've spent enough time in LA to know, like, you know, the many, many times I've been in a restaurant and then somebody walks out or walks in and there's 50 photographers just chasing them. Like, it's just, it's terrifying. Yeah. The first time I ever seen that was really at TIFF, you know, where, and I was saying to somebody, like, what is happening? Like, who are you chasing? And I said, we don't know. We just want to see somebody famous.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is insane.
Yeah. That's actually my favorite part about TIFF, is that every time I leave a hotel or a building, there's that moment where people go, and then they realize I'm nobody and they're like, oh, and I come to really enjoy disappointing them.
You're the anti-hero.
In my own story. Absolutely. I can't help you meet Oprah. I don't think Oprah wants to meet me. Like, that's not going to happen today. So maybe it is a certain level of cynicism.
It's crazy. I mean, just, you know, our obsession with consumerism and excess, we've learned it through this pandemic. You know, I told my son, who's very young, he turned 7 recently. And I said, you know, we can't go to the grocery store perhaps and find 72 different types of pasta, but that's okay. You know, we're going to have 5 types that we're really going to enjoy. And so he's starting to learn that. And I mean, we've been spoiled, right? It's our generation has had it all, at least in the Western world and the way we were brought up. I mean, we never lacked anything. And I think ultimately that's what the Dolce Vita is really a commentary on, is that this world of excess is not going to give you that spiritual satisfaction that, you know, if you notice, Marcello is very restless, and we all know people like that. And maybe on some level we are that person, you know, there's parts of him that we can all relate to. And I think when Steiner dies, like, Steiner is sort of like putting a mirror in front of Marcello and saying, this is who you can become. So he aspires to be this wealthy, successful, cultured man. And then he kills himself and kills his 2 children. I mean, that's like, it's such a shock in the movie, but what it teaches us, and I think what it teaches Marcello, is, you know, again, in pursuit, in chasing the false gods, you're going to end up potentially like this. So I think that's really the turning point. And that's where it's sort of like, it's less hopeful at that point for me in the movie. It's like, man, he's just lost his hero. Where are we going to go from here? And it leaves you wondering. It leaves you wondering and having a lot of questions.
Yeah, it's something that also runs through a number of his movies, is the sense of rot, the sense of, mm-hmm. like an unsustainable lifestyle that people are trying to stay ahead of some horrible tragedy that they can never fully avoid. And it's mortality, obviously, but it's also a sort of a moral decay. And this movie, more than, like, Roma kind of has it. And, well, Roma and Satyr can both sort of deal with that sort of decadence. But this one is, this one I find more disturbing because it's believable and reasonable. Like, the corruption is incremental. You're watching someone in the process of being hollowed out that probably could stop it if he wanted to. And that's the great failing on Marcello's part, is that he's so ambivalent about this world that he's in, which is clearly, if the film's stylized moments are supposed to be from his point of view, he knows, his brain is presenting it to him as this monstrosity, this grotesque, but he just can't bring himself to say, oh yeah, no, I shouldn't be doing this, any of this. This is all horrible. And the idea that that landed as a shock to people, I think is incredible, that no one had made a movie about, well, the paparazzi as a term didn't exist until the movie coined it, but no one had made a movie about the parasitic nature, right? Like previous films like Sunset Boulevard or All About Eve, I'm thinking like the American noir films that those, that world that they're in, they made the corruption a metaphor, or they made it more about a symbiotic relationship, like codependency rather than parasitic. And there's just nothing good that comes from what Marcello does. Nothing in his work produces anything positive. He's just stalking people and are insisting that he has a certain dignity. But the movie sees right through him. And so even though it's from his perspective, it's like this argument that Marcello's conscience is directing the film and showing us that this is all for nothing, this is all empty, and you're not doing anything to make the world a better place. Even, you know, the Ekberg in the fountain, right? It's, they're not really happy. They're just pretending, no. they're acting a version of romantic love. And it always amazed me too that that scene is the thing that everybody cites. It is, it's beautiful. And it's, you know, it's got a sexual charge, right?
Yeah.
But it's not a good thing that's happening. Like the, it's just drunk people in a fountain trying to pretend they're not awful people. I may be a little harsh here.
But he's also obsessed with the image of who she is. But if you notice, as soon as she starts howling and playing with the cat, he's sort of like rolling his eyes like, you know, you just killed this fantasy for me, you know? And I just found that really interesting, you know, because we're all in the presence of people that we've admired our whole lives. We've all met stars and, you know, there's always that moment of, you know, that disappointment that they don't really live up to your expectation. And I think he preferred to, you know, kind of experience the fantasy of her, the Sylvia character, as opposed to the real actress who really didn't have much to offer and beyond her beauty, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and the inherent contradiction, or not contradiction, the inherent irony in that, of course, is that as an image maker, he's the one responsible for people thinking that she is that person. Like, it's his own fault. Like, she can't, of course she can't live up to his fantasies. He built the fantasy in the first place. He knows it's not true.
Right. There's a lot of ironies. That's the thing. It's in Italian culture, even la dolce vita. I mean, we use it sarcastically, like say Norm's doing well and oh, new car. It must be nice. La dolce vita, you know, like it's, yeah. And, you know, I just thought about this recently too, how Rome has been through it once, like the fall of the Roman Empire, maybe on some levels, it's such an ancient culture and society and city that maybe Fellini was just saying like, you know, this could happen again. Don't be so arrogant and let's make sure we have our values. And, you know, he was a very thoughtful person. And I sometimes wonder myself, was he spiritual? Did he believe in God? Did, like, what guided his life? And a lot of these films really, I guess, are a reflection of that turmoil and conscious things that he was, you know, he was dealing with his own demons, I guess, and putting it on film.
Yeah. I think there is some sense, I mean, with all of his run-ins with the Catholic Church, I don't know that he would identify himself as a Catholic, but he was a better Catholic than a lot of the people who were professionally Catholic at the time, certainly.
Right.
And if you see this film as an exploration of temptation and what it takes to resist it, and the, you know, whether or not Marcello is resisting it is its own question, and I think he thinks he is, but he probably isn't. It's that weird thing where if you are anywhere close to glamour, to celebrity, not the people who are making movies on sets, but the red carpet side, right? The place where you are only there to celebrate. There's no room for critical space. There's no room for consideration of the merits of something. It's just like, what are you wearing? And I bet it was great that everybody got together and you all had fun. You were like a family. You know, like, we've all been in those situations where the talking points are the only thing that exists, and the camera goes on, and I can't watch red carpets for the Oscars or the Emmys. Although now apparently people are starting to push back and it's making it better, but I can't abide the simpering on the journalist side. It's incredibly unprofessional. I've I mean, it's not unprofessional, right? That's what they're there to do professionally. And yeah. Those guys, yeah, the pack journalists who roll around in Rome in the film, but I've seen it in Los Angeles, I've seen it in New York, where I've been mm-hmm. just as part of my own work, I've been to a premiere or to, I don't go to the parties. I find them all just so creepy. And I also know I don't belong there and everybody knows I don't belong there, which is fine. It's not false humility. I don't look like I belong in a movie set, which is totally fine. That's how movies work. But
yes.
I was in New York in 95. I did 5 junkets in a week. It was like a first week of December Christmas release run through. And one of them, the only one that played to a crowd, usually at junkets you see stuff in screening rooms, yeah. and then you roll into the interviews the next day. We saw 12 Monkeys. I think it was the Gotham Theater. Is that what it was called? On the Upper East Side. And it was the premiere. It was the world premiere. And for whatever reason, I somehow ended up on the red carpet 3 feet behind Bruce Willis. And this was in 1995 when Bruce Willis was basically, you know, like one of the giant A-list. Yeah, I mean, he was huge. And I'm there because I did this whole trip so I could meet Terry Gilliam. So that was fun. But I somehow ended up 3 feet behind Bruce Willis on the way into a movie theater through the red carpet, through the paparazzi. And they were yelling the vilest shit at him to get him to react. Demi's a whore.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. That's a verbatim.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it's my podcast. I can swear if I want to. Somebody actually said, I fucked Demi, just to see what he would do. And he was fine. He was he shut himself off and he walked through and he smiled and he squinted and he did everything right. And I've never been in a place where, you know, and there's 1,000 people on the street cheering. This is a huge event. There's the footlights. It's like, imagine a movie premiere in a movie. That's what this was.
Yeah.
And somehow a normal, ordinary human being, even if he is a movie star, has to walk through that and endure that for however many seconds it takes. And I was sort of drafting on it, and there was so much energy and tension and rage, like they were going to come out and grab him at any second. And they won't, because that's not what ever happens, but it was horrifying. And that's 35 years after La Dolce Vita, and it's just, yeah, that's the rot. Like, the movie La Dolce Vita is telling me what I'm going to experience in 1995. And that
foreshadowed
it. Yeah,
100%.
or just draws the line for you.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's weird that I didn't respond to that either the first time I saw it, because you're a kid and you have no experience of the world and you don't know what the industry does to people. I guess I'm just making excuses for my own ignorance here, but it was the late 80s. We didn't have the internet wasn't around to make everybody even worse. It is now. You can watch this movie and just think it's a celebration of that profession, because everybody is pretty nice. And they're all, I mean, all the malevolence is underneath. Nobody is outwardly horrible. But the whole thing they're doing is a cancer cell, and it's only going to get worse.
It is, and it's dehumanizing.
Yeah.
Even criticism has changed, you know, like it's not an art form anymore, or constructive. It's taken the human out of the equation, which is horrible. And it's all for the almighty dollar. I mean, it's like news stations need to sell 30-second ads and toilet paper and whatever. And you know, if it means dehumanizing somebody and ruining their life, so be it. I mean, it's business, right? And that's, I never saw that in Italy, actually. Like I spent quite a bit of time with Giancarlo Giannini, and we'd be in Rome at a cafe and people would sort of look and maybe say, maestro, you know, I love your work or whatever. And he goes, yeah, thank you. But he lives among the people. He lives in Rome and he's just like a part of society, and there's a reverence and respect, but not this like, you know, if you're having an affair, I want to expose it so that I can get the shot and make that money. Like, it's just, it's crude. And I'm glad that Fellini pointed, shined a spotlight on that and really made a commentary on how, you know, whether it's religion, whether it's parts of this business or whatever, it's really, you know, at what cost are we in pursuit of the almighty dollar? Like, it's like, you know, And I think that's the image of the gold Jesus flying over Rome. That's what that's about. It's just really like, you know, or the scene where they're waiting for the miracle. It's the same sort of thing. It looked like a film set. Like there was an entire production around these kids and the family and this miracle. And it's insane.
Yeah. And they're going through something really profound themselves because they need the miracle. Like that's the complete removal of human emotion. I mean, if you break up a marriage, if you report on the breakup of a marriage, then maybe the kids find out. You know, like there's always this awful human cost to stuff that's accepted and waved off now. Like the present day argument is, you know, shouldn't have gone into politics in the first place. It's like, yeah, that's true, but the kids didn't get the job. The royals. Okay, yeah, I mean, because this is happening this week. There are some photographs leaked out about one of the princes at the age of 7, and everybody's very upset about this. And yeah, of course they should be upset about it. Those are children, and they're supposed to be protected. And somehow also there's been the pushback of, well, the royals are a corrupt institution. It's like, yeah, but generations of these people have been born into this thing. It's not their call. I mean, I'm glad for Harry and Meghan walking away and making a statement, but until that happened, there was no precedent for, well, I guess Edward and Mrs. Simpson, but you know, like the idea of removing yourself from the society that you were born and raised into without any awareness of the world around you, that's harder on these people than we think it is, than the public thinks it is. And it's because we've demonized them for decades through this, through the industry, as you say, like they're just, it exists. And I think about the Jesus and it's like the Jesus. I think about the gold Jesus and and it's money and status, right? Like it's the combination of the two. Marcello may not be making the most money doing this, but he is well compensated, but he also gets to live in the world and have a little of that reflected glory. The church and the miracle are coming from two very separate places, but they're still tied up, right? In the religious awe that drives Catholicism. There's, the systems are designed to keep people chasing the shiny thing, and you spend, 2 hours and 45 minutes hoping Marcello realizes that that's not what he has to do anymore, or that the option is there to walk away.
Yeah. Well, I always found it odd as a kid to be in church, and then they go around with a basket, you know, collecting money. It wasn't a criticism. I would ask my parents, why are they doing that? Like, I'm here to reflect on my life, to pray for us, my family, and, you know, whatever, and meditate, and you know, I'm getting this plate shoved in my face. And then of course my dad was a communist, so he hated the church. So that's kind of how I grew up, listening to those kinds of conversations. But going back to your point about the paparazzi, a more, I guess, recent experience that we all felt so viscerally was Lady Diana, you know, when she's being chased down by those photographers and, you know, we still don't know exactly how she died. I mean, it was a tragic car accident. What provoked it, who knows? But it's just amazing how nothing has changed. Like, it's just, you can make La Dolce Vita today and it would be totally relevant and timeless.
Yeah. I wonder if there is a modern analog, a way to do it in the present day, to account for the internet, to account for, you know, 24-hour news coverage and all that stuff. I'm always fascinated by the possibilities in that sort of thing, because you would open up a whole different box, but the core of it would still be the same. I mean, I assume it would have to be. And every now and then people try, but it's always a reference to 8.5 instead of La Dolce Vita somehow. Like they always end up confusing the two and making the film about the filmmaker, about the talent rather than the journalist.
Yeah.
I guess it's because the people making the movie are more likely to identify with the talent.
Exactly. Well, I don't know how self-aware Fellini was. I think he was, in a lot of interviews I heard, he would get irritated when he had to explain or describe, you know, his intention of, you know, why did Steiner die? And what, you know, what does this mean? And, you know, on some level, I think he was speaking from his subconscious.
I would say
the fact that he had to explain it afterwards. I mean, the work kind of obviously speaks for itself, but I wonder why this film has had such an impact on so many people and so many filmmakers, and people are studying it, writing books about it, doing courses on it. Like, I wonder if that was even his intention, and if some of the analysis are even, you know, what Fellini had in mind, or if it's just like an academic construct or interpretation that had nothing to do with Fellini. I don't know.
Yeah,
like it seems like there's a whole industry around it.
It is kind of, I mean, you can make this argument about almost any movie that doesn't make a direct statement that works in an right. abstract form, but this film more than any of his other movies, I would say, like it's the Rorschach test. It's what do you take away from it? And that's the yeah. only valid impression, but it's also what Fellini is saying about you in the experience you have of watching his film. Your response defines how he would regard you in a strange way, and not the film, but the filmmaker. It just feels like he is leveling a withering judgment against the world that he is hailed in as a master already, and he's over it. Like, he just doesn't... he doesn't care what you think of the film, right? Like, the movie doesn't care what you think about it. It's never going to change. It's fixed in time and space. But the statement of the movie is, look, there's a way out. Take it or don't. I can't help you. Like, the movie can't tell you how to feel any more than you already do. You bring in your own baggage, and I think that's obviously a really convoluted argument for what all cinema does. The movies never change, we change, and so our view's different every time. But in this case, like, this is the one film of Fellini's where I just find I'm radically reinterpreting it every time, because my own
true.
Yeah, I have curdled, like, my own take on the industry. Or the industry's getting worse and it's got nothing to do with me, and I'm just seeing it and reflecting
You're
it back.
Just observing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, an American journalist made the mistake of asking Fellini, you know, as Marcello walks away in the final scene, they find his beast on the sand, and he, you know, it looks like there's a glimmer of hope, but does he change? And Fellini's like, you missed the, it doesn't matter if he changes. It matters if you've changed, if it, you know, provokes some kind of thought or stimulates conversation afterwards at the cafe or the bar that you go after you've seen the movie. That's what's important, you know.
I absolutely agree with
whereas
that.
Whereas here we're obsessed with, you know, save the cat and pet the dog and all these sort of screenwriting books that we've all read that point to this idea of, like, you have to have a huge arc where a character starts here and ends here and it has to be a clear, you know. And I just, man, that's so hard to, I just, yeah, that's not life. I mean, our days don't end that way. Our lives don't generally end that way. I mean, we try to change and be better, but do we, you know, it's.
Yeah. My favorite films are the ones that end on a beat of hope, on the possibility of happiness.
Right.
Mm. And then your empathy takes over, and that's that's when you stop the movie, because we can fill in the blanks. We just have to hope that it works out that way. This one. Yeah. This is, it's much more, you know, he doesn't have a profound revelation. He doesn't understand necessarily. I don't know that he knows that he could stop, but the world is telling him to. Like, everything around him is pointing in the other direction. And the ambiguity of whether or not he'll even see the signpost is fascinating to me, because you want to believe you would, but we have an omniscient view as a viewer. We see more than Marcello does. So, of course, we know. But I don't... My wife has a thing where she finds it absolutely excruciating to watch a character make the worst possible decision, even if the movie... Even if the movie knows that that's happening. You know, your Uncut Gems, something like that, where the film is actually getting off on watching somebody do the wrong thing.
Crash and burn.
But you can still be sympathetic to those characters. I mean, part of the drama is the flaw of that character in that way. I don't know that she's seen La Dolce Vita, and I wonder how she would take it, because it isn't unaware of Marcello's shortcomings, right? It knows who he is better than he does. And that's why I think that Fellini's choice to end it where he ends it and to just pull away and recede is to suggest that, you know, if Marcello doesn't find a way out, if he doesn't realize there is a way out, then this is who he'll always be, and that's the greater tragedy. And it's, you know, if you say it, if you lay it out like that narratively, it's pretty simple. It's not a complex film, but the execution of it and the artistry of it is just, it's so enthralling. And so, ultimately, so seductive, right? Because, again, one of those things that stuns me when I think about it there was a massive wave of chic Italian style that came out of this movie because people misinterpreted it and just wanted the glamour.
It's crazy. He really played. He seduced us with that. And yeah, who doesn't want to be, you know, Marcello in with a bow tie and those glasses and with the hair? I mean, it's just yeah. But maybe, you know, women today might find it misogynistic, or obviously it was told through the eyes and through the lens of, you know, a man 50 years ago. So there's that. But maybe, you know, I don't know. It's, I guess, in the vein of the neorealistic style, it's a slice of life. And maybe it's okay that he doesn't change. And maybe that's the message, that people don't generally change. And I could see it in Italy. I mean, just people will sit at a cafe for 3 hours smoking a cigarette, having an espresso, and read, like, life goes by and nothing really changes. Whereas we're in this frenetic, I'm in it too. And when I go to Italy, it takes me a month to get into their rhythms of how life is just so slow. And they're not as affected by the American dream as we are, you know, like if they sit at a cafe for the next 50 years and stare and watch the world go by, they're okay with that. And that's what it felt like at the end. It's like, oh God, that's so Italian. You know, like, it's just like, hey, shit happens, you know, life happens and I'm never going to change, but that's okay, you know.
Yeah, if he does change, it will be incremental. He might just be a little more courteous, a little nicer to people, or just a little more aware. And that would be a huge improvement for him. That would be, you know, massive personal growth. It's just that the movie isn't really interested in him because it's already given up on him.
Yeah.
Because he's still part of that world. I wonder if, you know, like, Fellini would have had more time for him if he... Yeah, I don't even know what I was going to say. Because he's the writer and he controls it and he can do whatever he wants and he just chooses to put him in that direction.
Yeah. Well, I had just the great luck and pleasure of meeting the Kubrick family, and Jan Harlan and I became friends. So we talked a lot about things and his movies and his career and his life. And I said, was he hopeful? Because I watched Clockwork Orange and it's just like, oh my God, it's like, it really shows that innate dark side. Like you were saying earlier about your wife not liking to see a character just make bad choices and crash and burn. But yet, if there's an accident at the side of the road, we all look, you know, or if there's, you know, like, I mean, there's MMA fighting where there's two guys in a cage kneeing each other in the face to the point where they're bleeding and unconscious. Like, I just think maybe there's an innate kind of dark side to us all. And you know, so my question to Jan was he spiritual and was he hopeful? He said, yes, of course. That's why he kept making movies. He just kept, it was an exploration of that. It's like at a certain point we have as humans, the choice to do better, and whether we, you know, make that choice or not, I think that's what makes interesting drama and interesting entertainment ultimately.
Yeah. It's the constant challenge, right? To be optimistic and hopeful, to want things to go well, even when we're pretty sure they're not going to, spiritually or otherwise.
Yeah. Some of that's cultural too, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I'm, I was raised Jewish, so we have the hope for the best, expect the worst, and figure out,
same.
That, you know, it's just not going to happen anyway.
It's the same, yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't have too high expectations. You don't want to be disappointed.
Yeah,
all that kind of stuff.
Though. Pessimists are only ever confirmed happy or surprised. You know, like, that's the arc.
That's the range of
options available. I did want to ask though. I've told you my red carpet experience, and the film is all about all of those. And I know that the Cuban just had a drive-in red carpet premiere, so I got to ask about that. What was it like, and how did it happen? How does it work?
Well, they, you know, we sort of queued up and I heard announced on the big screen that here's the director, Sergio Navarreta, and the writer, Alessandro Piccione. And so we just drove up and stopped, and then all the cameras were to our right. And on the left were the hosts.
So you're literally driving up.
Literally drive. It's like a drive-through, big red carpet. And then they handed me an iPad that they had sanitized and whatever, and we're all in masks, and then take the mask off. And it was just, I was overwhelmed because I could see myself on the big screen, which I hate being on camera, so that was very uncomfortable.
Sure.
And then I had journalists on the right and then the hosts on the left. And I thought it was going to be sort of like, I'm really happy to be here. I hope everyone enjoys the movie and let the movie speak for itself. But then one of the hosts said, what inspired you to make this movie? And I was just like, oh my God. Like, it just threw me completely, because I wasn't in a mental place to have a conversation about it. It felt silly to be having it in that environment, but it all worked out, and it was very fascinating, to say the least. I'll never forget it.
Yeah. We're in such a weird place now where the notion of glamour as defined by La Dolce Vita doesn't exist right now. You can't. There's no point. There are people, you know, like doing looks in their homes, which is fascinating. And I find kind of lovely and fun, too, watching people, you know, the bookshelf behind you has become the status symbol, right? So when somebody shows up with no books, that's a comment. And,
right.
Again, it's part of what Marcello does. We want to see who they really are. We want to see into their lives. And we have this opportunity. I've seen people in their homes and their desks and dealing with their kids and their pets and in the course of trying to perform this version of themselves. And all of that is gone now. So the idea of doing a virtual red carpet from behind, were you actually behind the wheel of the car? Because that would be even stranger. Yeah.
It was strange because I had to physically drive. And
yeah, because I was just thinking, would it have been a limo? No, you can't have a stranger driving you in this situation. All of these mechanics have been disassembled.
Yeah. It's bizarre. And, you know, somewhere... I also went to York, so somewhere around university, I was thinking and obsessing a lot about true self versus false self. You know, I've had numerous debates about it with my partner, with therapists, with whoever. It's just like this idea of distilling down to who we truly are. And, you know, some, I guess in the more spiritual realms, they call it the soul and, you know, the true self. And then we put the mask on and we become the father, the filmmaker, the whatever, whatever. And, the other day I did a press conference at Ontario Place, and it was so overwhelming just having all those cameras in my face. And somebody said to me, well, it's okay. You're going to have a mask on. Right. So here we are again, putting a different kind of mask, like a physical medical mask on to hide who we really are. And on top of that, I put like a bandana around it. So it just gave me another layer of protection, you know, but anyway, we're in strange times. And, you know, this whole idea of true self versus false self for me was the core message that I connected to in La Dolce Vita. And really, you know, it forced me to kind of do some soul searching and distill or process what happens in the film industry. So right now I'm on a kind of a virtual press tour promoting the movie. Mm-hmm. And you want to make sure that that doesn't affect you in a way that ends up staying, where it's like you get a good review, you have a high, and you know, everyone's patting you on the back, oh great job. You get a bad review and it's like, oh, I'm doomed, I'll never work again. Like it's so extreme, and it plays with your emotions. And so anyways, I mean, it's all part of growth, and the older you get, the easier it gets, I guess. And you know, to your earlier point about Bruce Willis, I think eventually you just do this and you just focus on, you stay in your lane, right?
Yeah,
you sure as best you can.
Yeah, no, you do the work, and you, I mean, we have it too from on the other side of the keyboard, right? Or the other side of the screen. You just have to keep going.
Yeah.
And eventually, if you start, I mean, as a critic, if I start shaping my responses to the way I think the audience wants me to behave, I'm not serving anybody. I'm not serving myself. No. I'm not serving them. I'm not serving the art that I'm watching. All you can do is try to be the best version of yourself, right? And as far as La Dolce Vita goes, he's clearly not. And that's like the crux of the film, the test of the movie is whether he'll figure it out.
Yeah, and he has someone sitting at home who apparently loves him unconditionally and says, come home to me. And even that is not enough to ground him or to, you know, like, so it's, yeah, that, I mean, that's what I think your wife would have a hard time with. It's like he has all these choices, you know, where he could seemingly be more integrated, grounded as a human being and ultimately happy. But he's out here in the orbit searching for it in this kind of abstract, ethereal way that is just not real.
Yeah. Well, they do have better lighting, right? So I can see why he's drawn to it.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Even in the prostitute's basement with the water flooding and everything, it's still, he's in a, you know, he's a beautiful tux and his hair is perfect and she looks wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's seductive. That's why it's evil, right? Like, that's the whole point.
Yeah. 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 It's just, and as a filmmaker, it just gave me so much joy to revisit a movie that has meant so much to me. And now whenever there's a scene in any of my movies that's quote unquote Fellini-esque, my cinematographer knows exactly what I'm talking about. The poser knows what to do. It's, you know, for those who know cinema, they get the nod. And for those who are too young to know who Fellini is, well, you know, hopefully they'll discover him at some point.
Yeah, that history's not going anywhere. It's just waiting for them.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing too.
Exactly. Exactly.
My thanks to Sergio Navarreta, whose new film, The Cuban, is screening at the Sunset Drive-In in Barrie, Ontario tonight, Tuesday, August 11th, and at the Starlight Drive-In in Stony Creek next Tuesday, August 18th. You can find future screening information at thecubanmovie.com. Thanks also to Suzanne Cheriton. She knows what she did. Also, I forgot, The Bad and the Beautiful predates La Dolce Vita by like a decade, so there was a sort of awareness that celebrity doesn't guarantee contentment, but Fellini's film does feel like the more considered statement. You can find Sergio on Twitter at SergioDirector, all one word, and you can find La Dolce Vita on Blu-ray and DVD in the Criterion Collection. It's not currently streaming on the Criterion channel, but you can rent it in Canada on YouTube and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where in addition to writing about film and television, I host a bunch of podcasts these days. Go check those out. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. Dancing in fountains is okay, I think, but let other people have a turn. I'll see you next time.